Well, it's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm very thankful for the opportunity, thankful for the invitation from the session here at the church, and thankful for my friendship with Jason, and I'm thankful to be his parents' pastor. they're really wonderful folks, and it's good to have them in the congregation at Grace. Well, let me say a couple of words before I get started. I was told that this particular session is a little bit more academic than the other ones, and so it will be a little bit more. It will be a little bit more on that side of things, and then we'll think more pastorally in the following lectures. I want to take you through something that I've thought about for quite a while now. I want to think together about the structure of the Sermon on the Mount and how it influences and affects the rest of Matthew's Gospel. I realize some of this is going to be small, some of it's larger, some of the stuff that I'd really like for you to see is a little smaller, but I could only fit it on there at the font that it is. But we're going to look at some introductory matters. We're going to think about the theme of sonship, the theme of fatherhood. We're going to think about the developing family concept that is not only in the Sermon on the Mount, but also in the book of Matthew itself. And then we're going to think about how Jesus really establishes a new family. And then what we're going to do in that final point is we're going to test our theory. In other words, we're going to take a particular scripture that's been interpreted one way, and we're going to see how, if we look at it through the lens that we've been looking at it through, and as we contextualize it, we'll hopefully see that it supports the theory that Matthew's gospel is built on the structure of family. Well, with that introduction in mind, I want you to also understand, I want to lay all my cards on the table, be up front with you. I want you to understand that Matthew's structure is notoriously difficult to pin down. In fact, this is Donald Hagner is the scholar who says that the structure is notoriously difficult, but I have two quotes from another scholar by the name of R.T. France. And R.T. France says this, "But it must be recognized that no two commentators ever agree on the right way to analyze the text in detail." And then he goes on to say this, "Even if they agree on the main divisions, in the case of Matthew, even the main divisions are still debated." Now that doesn't give us much hope, does it? Well, it even gets worse. But I want to show you some of the ways, some of the more popular ways that Matthew has been structured. First of all, and you're probably most familiar with the concept of the New Moses. People will say, well, there are five dialogues in the book of Matthew, and a scholar by the name of Benjamin Bacon came up with this theory. He said there are five main talks that Jesus gives, and he says, well, think about it. He said, we have five Pentateuchal books, five books in the Old Testament. We have five books in the Psalms. We must have here somebody that reflects a character in the Old Testament. And then he started putting together things like Jesus going up on a mountain and revealing the law. And who does that sound like? Well, Bacon said, well, that sounds like Moses. And so what we have here in Matthew's gospel is the presentation of a new Moses. And then we have a chiastic formula. And that chiastic formula looks like this. It switches back and forth. There's narrative, there's discourse, there's narrative, there's discourse. And it's built on a chiastic structure, A, B, B, A kind of format. And then you have the threefold division idea. In other words, if you look at 4:17 and 16:20, which we're not going to do, you can jot those down and look at those if you'd like. One of the things that you see is that, these are pivotal points in the book of Matthew. And so everything before 4:17 is of one section, and then 4:17 to 16:20 is of another section, and then 16:20 to chapter 28 is of another section. So there's a threefold division in the book, and that's not widely accepted. And then there's the lectionary hypothesis, and I always love to find these things. This is a popular one, and what this particular view of Matthew's structure says is that Matthew really is an enlargement of Mark's gospel, and that enlargement of Mark's gospel is really liturgical in form. You always think of high church guys coming up with these sorts of things. And then there's Robert Gundry, who says, and this is just absolutely stellar, right? He says, I think there's no plan at all for Matthew's gospel. It's an indefinite plan. And so those are the things that you tend to look at when you look at the structure of Matthew's gospel. It's interesting, these oftentimes scholars play it safe and they'll say, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the new Moses idea, and then I'm going to take one of these other ideas, and I'm going to put them together, and my idea is going to be something similar to what you find in two of these ideas. R.T. France says this. This is the most disconcerting thing, I think, that you can think of when you're trying to pinpoint the structure of Matthew's gospel. He says, in discerning the structural pattern, sorry for the typo, there is, of course, unlimited scope for the imaginative commentator to discover patterns of which the text gives no hint and which are more likely to be in the mind of the modern reader with his love of neat tables of contents than in that of Matthew. That's kind of a scary thing, especially when you're proposing a structure of Matthew's gospel. And I'll tell you where this idea came from. I decide every year I put two proposals in for the Evangelical Theological Society, and I decided that I was going to put a standard one in, and a standard one for me is something on B.B. Warfield. I wrote my dissertation on Warfield, and so I always submit something on Warfield, and usually that gets accepted. And on a whim, I said to myself, I'm going to present something, a bold new strategy for the structure of Matthew's gospel, and this is the one they accepted. And so I'm in a little bit of trouble, and you're going to help me with it. So here's the trusting in the text more than in the imagination. My basic proposal is that Matthew's structure is familial. Now, what I want you to understand is this. I want you to understand that when we work through the material today, we're not going to work through all of Matthew's gospel. I have in mind how the rest of the gospel works itself out in relationship to my thesis, but really we're going to cover just up through the first 12 chapters. If you want to talk about how this thesis works itself out into the rest of those chapters, we can surely do that. But what my main concern is to show you how the Sermon on the Mount provides that familial basis and then how it reaches out into Matthew's gospel, at least through chapter 12. Well, the first thing that we need to think about when we think about the structure of Matthew's gospel and this familial relationship is the theme of sonship. Now, this is, I think, one of the most exciting things in the book of Matthew, and let's just walk through it. So when you open up to Matthew's gospel, you encounter one of those sections of scripture that makes the heart flutter. You encounter a genealogy, right? You read that and you start to palpitate and you start to say, oh my, right? Well, this genealogy is one of those genealogies that does several things at one time. For instance, one of the things that it does is it mirrors Genesis 1 through 2:25. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you can just kind of get it into your head what those two texts say, you'll be good. If you want to flip to one and the other, you can do that as well, but I'm not going to spend a great deal of time here. In Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, you find the first of two creation accounts. And then in 2:4 through 2:25, you find the second. Now, Why two creation accounts? Well, I think it's very simple. I think what Moses is doing in the very first account is giving us a very large account, a very broad sweep account of creation on the first day, on the second day, on the third day, and so on. So this is a general account of creation. On the second count of creation, he is focusing, narrowing. He says, let me tell you about the sixth day, the day upon which God made man. And let me tell you about that creation. So he gets specific. Now, if you go to Matthew's gospel, one of the things that you find is the genealogy. And in 1 through 17, that's what you find. You find Jesus' genealogy. But then in 18 through 25, what do you find? You find Matthew saying, now let's take a closer look at Jesus' birth. And so I think you have something that mirrors, and this isn't original with me. Other scholars point this out. What you have here is Matthew mirroring Genesis. What I want you to notice is, and again, this is something that other scholars have pointed out, there's a chiasm in 1 through 17. Now, what's a chiasm? A chiasm is a pattern. It's a pattern where that you find A, B, B, A. Let me give you an example. Peanut butter and jelly, I love jelly and peanut butter, right? And love is in the middle, and peanut butter and jelly reverse positions on either side. So you get A, B, C, C, B, A. Peanut butter is A, jelly is B, love is C, and then it reverses itself. I can't remember which one I said. All right, you get the idea. All right, now what do you have? In verse 1, you have Christ, David, Abraham. In verse 17, you have Abraham, David, Christ. A, B, C, C, B, A. And so the genealogy is telling us something. What is the genealogy telling us? Well, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but what is the genealogy telling us? The genealogy is telling us that this is the account of the birth of the Messiah, who is the son of David. Something that you may or may not realize is that the 14 generations from, 14 generations from, 14 generations from, it's a list of three separate 14 generations. Now, why is that so significant? Well, because the name David in the Hebrew, when numbers are assigned to each letter, equals 14. So Matthew is doing a great deal. Not only is he pointing out the name of David repeatedly in this genealogy, he arranges it around David, and he puts it numerically after David's name. So Jesus is the son of David. Now, why does that become important? Because the inclusio that we're going to see in 1:18 through 25. Now, what's an inclusio? An inclusio is basically two bookends. It's a word or a phrase or an idea that appears at the beginning of the text, and then that same word, phrase, or idea appears at the end of a text. Now, I want you to catch this. There's an inclusio in 1:18 through 25, and it's really neat. In 1:21, she will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. In 1:25, you find that mirrored. She had given birth to a son, and he called his name Jesus. And in 23 is the middle, is the heart. Who is this one who is the son called Jesus? Bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. This son of David, who will be born into the line and lineage of David, is actually the son of God. He's actually God with us. And so Matthew's telling us a lot here about Jesus in these early chapters. He's setting us up for one simple thing. We need to understand that he's what? He's a son, he's a son, he's a son, he's a son of David, and he's the son of God. Now, that actually bears itself out. If we move on, we find my three sons. Now, if you want, you want to know where that show came from, right here. Right here. Biblical scholar. No, just kidding. Don't, no. Dave, I'm feeling a little woozy. Dave told me if I don't drink water, he said, I'm not going to resuscitate you. I'm just saying. Dave, did I say Dave? Sorry, Jason. All right. So, yeah, you're definitely not going to resuscitate me. All right. So, my three sons. Get out your Bibles if you don't have them open already. All right. Where's my Bible? All right. All right. I want you to look Matthew. Oops. That's not good. Okay. Look in Matthew chapter 2. And in Matthew chapter 2, what you're going to find is you're going to find three separate sections. And the three separate sections are going to deal with three separate aspects of the one son of David who is the Son of God. The very first one is the typological aspect of Jesus as son. Now, this particular section goes from 2:12 to 23. It opens with 2:11, warned by God in a dream. It closes in 2:22 with warned by God in a dream. But what I want you to notice is this. I want you to notice what it says in 2:15. It says that this was done to fulfill the words of Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I called my son. Jesus is the typological, is the fulfillment of the typological Israel. So this is the typological aspect of Jesus' sonship that comes into play here. Then I want you to notice this. In 3:1 through 17, we find at the very beginning a voice out of the wilderness, and it closes with a voice out of the heavens. And what does that voice say? It parallels what the voice out of the wilderness says. But this time the voice is from God who says, "This is my son." Now, this is the ontological sonship of Christ. Now, that word shouldn't scare us. On just means being. In his very being, apart from creation, apart from anything else in eternity, this is God's son, his beloved son, the second person of the Trinity. So we find that aspect come into play here. And then in 4:1 through 11, what do we find? We find the eschatological son. This is the second Adam. The first Adam was challenged in the garden and failed. This is the eschatological Adam, or the second Adam, who is challenged in the wilderness and succeeds. And so what you find is you find three aspects of Christ's sonship. Now, remember, this is the Son of David who is the Son of God. This is the Son of God right in the middle who is both the typological Son and the second Adam. This is the eschatological Son. Now, one of the things that you need to understand is that these three verses actually come between two pillar passages. And I call them pillar passages because it's really, once you begin to look at it like this, really fascinating. Let me show you what I mean. If you look on the first side of this, I said that the one passage started in 2:12. Now go back to 2:1 through 11. 2:1 through 11. And then on the other side is 4:12 through 22. Now those are the pillar passages. Catch this. Look at this slide. In the very first one, you have a passage of birth announcement. A birth announcement of who? The Son. 5:2. Let's read that together. Let's just read that. It says this. "And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Now, the question is, who comes in this passage? Not Judeans, not Israelites, Gentile magi come. Now go to the other side. Go to the other side where it's 4:12 through 22. And there you have a birth announcement of the Son. It is Isaiah chapter 9. And look at what it says. "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles." Who's this birth announcement to? The Gentiles. And who comes, right after this birth announcement, who comes to Jesus? Jewish fishermen. The structure of this is very suggestive, almost almost chiastic, if you will. So there's a birth announcement on either side of the three aspects of the Son, who is the Son of David, who is the Son of God. And the interesting thing, I think, is that the first announcement is to Jews, Gentiles come. Second announcement is, has the Gentiles in mind, Jews come. So what we have here, what we see is that the first four chapters of Matthew's gospel really help us to see that it's about sonship. Somebody comes up to you on the street and says, what's the first four chapters of Matthew's gospel about? You go, oh, that's easy. It's about sonship. Sonship's written all over it. Now, I think the lesson to the pillar passages is that the family that Jesus came to establish is larger than the Jewish people think. Because if you reach forward and think about what Paul says in Romans chapter 9 and Romans chapter 10 and 11, he says, not everybody that's an Israelite is of Israel, right? There is more to Israel than meets the eye. So I think the lesson here that Matthew's plugging in this idea of sonship is that the family is bigger. Well, let's move on now to the second point, the theme of fatherhood. Now, let me just say this. We've got sonship, and you kind of expect sonship to keep on going. It's been introduced. It's been dissected. It's been set apart with the pillar passages. What do you expect now? Well, the question that you have to ask yourself is, how would you summarize the Sermon on the Mount? How might you summarize that? And there are a number of ways that anybody might summarize that particular section of Scripture. But I've come to realize, in my study anyway, that I summarize the Sermon on the Mount by looking at it through the lens of fatherhood. Now, what do I mean by that? It's too small. I'm really sorry. That's really small. Well, there are 17 occurrences of Father in the Sermon on the Mount. If you look in the Sermon on the Mount, look, the body of the Sermon on the Mount is in 5:17. Let me just say this to you. Let's just run through this briefly. The Sermon on the Mount opens with Jesus going up on a mountain in 5:1. He goes up on the mountain, he sits down, he opens his mouth. If you flip over to chapter 7, it's in 8:1, he closes his mouth, he gets up, and he comes down from the mountain. That's the opening. And then, if you notice, you have Beatitudes or blessings that start the sermon. And then if you look in the end of the Sermon on the Mount, you have what amount to cursings or warnings about where to build your house and things like that. And then what you have is, you have, after a couple of introductory remarks, you have the body of the sermon. The body of the sermon begins in 5:17, and it closes in 7:11. Or is it 7:12? 7:12. How do we know that? Well, because in between these two verses, which have this phrase, the law and the prophets, you find a highly structured sermon. So what encloses this highly structured sermon is the law and the prophets, that phraseology. Now, between those two phrases, the law and the prophets, is the body of the sermon. And between those, you get 17 occurrences of Father. You get 8 on either side, and they're very interesting. You can find chiasms in the middle. You can find corresponding verses, but if you really look at this, in 5:16, it begins with your Father who is in heaven, it climaxes with our Father, and then it ends with my Father. There's a lot here when you think about it around that theme of fatherhood, but I'm not going to say much more than that. I'm going to move on so we can cover some more ground. Let me now move to some of that body of the Sermon on the Mount, 5:21 through 48. I want you to look at these different. I want you to look at these different topics. 5:21 through 48, Jesus covers 6 topics. Okay, Now, when you look at them, their murder, their adultery, divorce, vows, resisting enemies, loving enemies, when you look at them, the question then becomes, well, how do you put any one of those together with any other thing? Did Jesus just sort of pick, was he doing the, you know, the grocery store dance? You ever see the grocery store dance? You know? Think so. All right. Anyway, did he just pick these off the shelf and use them for illustration? Well, I think there's a structure here. And I want to show you the structure. When you think about murder, what's the opposite of murder? Loving your enemies, right? If the opposite of murder is love the one you want to murder, then that sort of fits, right? What about divorce? Well, divorce would be keeping your vows, right? If you're gonna commit adultery, you'd resist your enemies. Now, I want you to think about this for just a minute. I think what you have here is you have a basic formula that says that we are to resist either our enemies by giving them our coat or going with them an extra couple of miles, or we resist those who would do us harm by leading us away from our vows by gouging out our eye or cutting off our hand. So we are resisting ourselves in some way, shape, or form in order to submit ourselves to God and His law. And why do we do that? Well, we do that because of what you find in chapter 5 at the end of this section. At the end of this section, you find, look at verse 45. So that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. You do these things that you might be sons. And I think when you think about what you're being asked to do, it's kind of a startling thing. But what you're being told is, this is what it's like to be in the family of God as sons. The next section is the middle section. And the middle section basically encompasses from chapter 6, verse 1, and it goes through verse 18. Now, these three follow a certain pattern. The Lord's Prayer, giving alms, the Lord's Prayer, and fasting have a similar pattern to them. They begin with when, it's followed by instruction, it's followed by the phrase, truly I say to you, which is followed by but you. Here's an example in verses 2 and 3. When you give to the poor, truly I say to you that they have their reward in full, but you. And then there's instruction offered. So what you find in these verses is basically we are being told this is what it means to be a son in the most intimate sense. Think about the way this opens. Beware of practicing righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. We've got an eye to our Father in heaven when we do these things, when we give alms, when we pray, and when we fast. And then there's the last section. And the last section begins in 6:19, and it goes through 7:12. Now, I want you to see this. That's the basic pattern in 6:19 and 34. There's a treasure principle, there's the parable of the eye, and then there's encouragement. Notice in 7:1 through 12, you have a very similar thing. You have a principle, and it regards judging. You have a parable of the eye again, and then you have some encouragement at the end of that. Now, I'm not going to spend time unpacking what this means, except to say this. The very first one is store up treasure in heaven. I will say this just so you can get this. Store up treasure in heaven and not on earth. Well, what does that have anything to do with the eye as the lamp of the body? And if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. What does that have to do with anything? If you go to the Matthew chapter 20 and the steward, the man who hires the people to come and work in his field at different hours in the day, and then calls them all in at the end of the day and pays them the same thing. He has grumblers. And he says, you think I have an evil... He says, I'd rather read it. Sorry. He says, verse 13, but he replied to one of them, friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I chose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I chose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? Now, does anyone have a note on that particular one? Who has a New American Standard? Do you have a note on it? What's your note say? Is your eye bad? Is your eye evil? Because I am good. In other words, let's go back to the Sermon on the Mount now. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy or good, that's the word good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad or evil, your whole body will be full of darkness. To have an evil eye is to lack generosity. To be generous is to have a good eye. Now, I want you to think about that understanding when it comes to do not lay up treasure for yourselves in heaven, but lay up for yourselves treasure. Do not lay up for yourselves treasure on earth, but lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. How do you do that? By being generous. And then notice what it says next. Now, you can't have two masters. You either serve God or money. All of that, 6, 19 through 24, hangs together, doesn't it? Now, how do you then understand encouragement? Encouragement is not just left on its own, but now you understand it in terms of if you trust your Father and He is your God, then you can trust that He will care for you better than He cares for the flowers of the field. That's the idea. And when you go to judging in the parable of the eye in 7, 1 through 12, the encouragement is that if you knock, your Father will answer. So there's the fatherhood of God is here in this parable. What's the lesson? Well, the lesson is that there's a son and there's a father, but the question is, how do we get into that relationship? And we get into that relationship through the Beatitudes. Think about the Beatitudes like this. The Beatitudes help us to understand how the Father of Jesus becomes our Father. Now, let's just look at the Beatitudes for a minute. Notice they have a structure as well. The very first beatitude is, for theirs is the kingdom. And the last beatitude is, for theirs is the kingdom. But the six in between is all future. For they shall be, they shall be, they shall inherit, and so on. Now, when you look at those first four beatitudes, notice what you see. You see there's a person who's poor in spirit. They recognize their spiritual poverty. What do they do as a result? They mourn over it. They humble themselves before God. And what else? The fourth beatitude. They hunger and thirst for a righteousness that is alien to them. Now, that makes sense when you go back to chapter 3 and John says, I shouldn't baptize you. And Jesus says, let it be so now that all righteousness might be fulfilled. Who is the one from whom we get righteousness? It's Jesus who fulfills all righteousness. And His righteousness that comes to us is an alien righteousness because it's something we lack. Remember what Jesus says in chapter 8. He says, I did not come for the righteous, for those who think they're righteous. I came for sinners, for those who hunger and thirst for the righteousness that only I can bring. So what we find here is that the Beatitudes actually invite us in to the fatherly relationship that the Son enjoys with Him. Now I want to just move on for a minute and look at this developing sense of family that we're going to look at now. I have already forgotten myself. What's the time frame? When are we done? 4:30. Okay, you listen fast, I'll talk fast, and then we'll get there at the same time. All right, now I want you to notice this developing family. This is really, I think, neat. If you look at the wider context is not just the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount really begins in its wider context in chapter 4. And look at chapter 4 and verse 23. And then thumb over to 9:35. And if you thumb over to 9:35, you'll find the exact same verse. And what that's called is another inclusio, which means that the Sermon on the Mount goes from 5 through 7, and then you have chapters 8 and 9. Now, why is it, scholars wonder, why is it that 8 and 9 get grouped in with the Sermon on the Mount? Well, I want to tell you why I think chapters 8 and 9 are placed there. There are two people that Jesus deals with, and I'm gonna pare down a little bit here so that you can see this. There are two people that Jesus deals with, and the two people that he deals with are a paralytic and a woman with the flow of blood. Now, when you look at these people, look for instance in 8:22. In 8:22, that's wrong. Look with me, look with me in 9:2. Jesus saw their faith. This is what he says to the paralytic: "Take heart, my son, your sins are forgiven." And then look at what he says when he talks to the woman. Look at what he says to the woman in 9:22: "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well," or "your faith has saved you." We're not going to take the time to flesh all of this out, but it's absolutely fascinating that these are, chapter 8, remember, "I didn't come to call the righteous or those who think they're righteous, I came to call the sinners." And here are two people, and their infirmities represent their inadequacies. And Jesus, by their faith, invites them in and calls them son and daughter. It's this developing family that we see in 8 and 9. Now, let's test the theory, okay? Let's test the theory here. First of all, we need to lengthen the stakes of our understanding. And I want you to go to chapter 10 and look in chapter 10. This is right after the closure of the Sermon on the Mount. And from chapter 10 to the end of chapter 12, we have another section. Now, this other section begins with Jesus naming 12 apostles. Now, why does he do this? Herman Ritterbos in The Coming of the Kingdom says, these 12 disciples represent the new people of God, the new family of God, if you will. Now, what does Jesus say about this new family of God? Well, he says in verse 21 and verse 24 and verse 34 and verse 37 that this new family is going to be persecuted. But this is what he says. Notice verse 25. "If they have called the master of the house," which is a phrase that, which is a word, the oikonomos, the master of the house, the head of the house. If the head of the house, if they called the head of the house, the master of the house, Beelzebul, how much more will they malign those of the household? Now all of a sudden, he's identifying us, his disciples, as his household over which he is the head. And then notice this. This is really something. We'll come back to chapter 11 in a minute, but if you go to 12:46, notice what happens. The biological family of Jesus, his mother and brothers, come to take him away because they hear he's crazy. And he looks around and he says, "My mother and brother? Who are my mother and brothers?" And he points to his disciples and he says, "These are my mother and my brothers." You see how the family theme just sort of weaves its way in now. And now let's go back to chapter 11. Back to chapter 11, it appears right in this context where the new family is very pronounced. It's constituted and the biological is rejected. Notice in chapter 11, it starts with John's question. John's question is, "Are you the one or should we expect another?" Now, I want you to think about this for a minute. When John's disciples come for John, because he's in prison, and ask this question of Jesus, Jesus just basically says, "Tell him to go read Isaiah 35. The answer is, "I'm the expected one." But then the disciples depart, and Jesus turns around and he faces people who have been there during this question. And he says, "Who did you come out to see when you saw John?" Now, this is the interesting thing. He does not go back and quote Isaiah 40 like Matthew does in chapter 3. Here, he takes the quote from Malachi 3. He says, this is the one you saw, this one who came to prepare a way for me. And then he does something else. In Malachi, he moves to chapter 4. And he says, this is the Elijah who was to come. Remember, so now he quotes Malachi 3 and he says, this is what John came to do. Very similar thing that he came to do in Isaiah 40, but I'm quoting Malachi 3. And now Jesus says, let's move on to Malachi 4. This John the Baptist is the Elijah who was to come. Now think about this. Here is the ironic thing. It's almost as if Jesus is explaining why John has this problem. Go back to Malachi and look in chapter 4. What is the purpose of Elijah, according to Malachi? The purpose of Elijah, according to Malachi, is in verse 6, and he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. Now, if you go back to chapter 10 and look at what Jesus says in the chapter right before chapter 11, he says, I've come to turn a father against son and a daughter against mother, and all of that family strife. And John, who hears this, says, wait a minute. I thought my job in preparing the way for you was to turn the heart of a father to his son and so on. But you just taught that you were going to destroy families. Are you the coming one, or should we expect another? And Jesus is saying, I am the one, but you don't have the right understanding of family at this point. Family is not ethnicity. Family is faith, and that's what family has always been. That's why the gospel was preached to Abraham, says Galatians chapter 3, and those who are of faith are the children of Abraham. You've got a wrong understanding of family. And so it's almost as if Jesus is explaining why it was that John the Baptist had this question. And he's saying, you need the understanding of family that I'm bringing to you. And so I think that Matthew is built on this familial structure. And I think the first 12 chapters reiterate that. I hope that's not imagination. I think it's textual. But look, we don't have time for questions. No, I'm just kidding. I'm finished. Do you want to? Yeah.